Admiral James Savridis is one of the most admired admirals of his generation and the only admiral to serve as Supreme Allied Commander at NATO. His new book is Sea Power, the History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans, and it takes readers on a voyage through the world's most important bodies of water, providing the story of naval power as a driver of human history and a crucial element in our current geopolitical path. A retired four-star admiral with 35 years of active service in the Navy, Savridis served as the Supreme Allied Commander for Global Operations at NATO from 2009 to 2013. Again, the new book is Sea Power, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Admiral Savridis to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. A great pleasure. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Joe.
Well, give us a sense, sir, of what brought you to want to tell this history of the oceans and, yes, about their power.
First and foremost, the oceans are vital to the United States because of geopolitics. As we look around the world, Korea, the eastern Mediterranean off of Syria, the Arctic in the high north, pushing back Russia, China in the South China Sea, so much of our ability to influence global events swings on sea power. Secondly, trade. Joe, 95% of the world's trade moves by sea. And thirdly, it's the environment. 70% of the oxygen we breathe comes from photosynthesis in the oceans. So there are enormous U.S. issues that demand our attention in the oceans. And then secondly, on a personal note, having spent almost four decades in the Navy, and if you total up all the days I spent at sea, it would add up to 11 years. Mm. I spent a lot of time out there in an office with a really good view, and I wanted to share what it's like to be at sea. So for all those reasons, it felt like the right time to write the book.
Given our current situation as it comes to the debate in Washington over trade, the debate in Washington and the world regarding the climate, where do you think we are now? And because it seems like it's a precarious situation.
I think the Trump administration has made two missteps that matter in this regard. The first was withdrawing from something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was the largest trade agreement ever negotiated between a dozen countries in Asia and here in the Americas. We pulled out of that. I think that's a mistake, and it'll create an opening for China, which they will surely exploit to their advantage. And then secondly, and worse, is walking away from the so-called Paris Treaty on the Environment, COP21, which is an agreement among virtually every nation in the world to try and get global warming under control. If we don't do that, over time, the oceans will warm, they will acidify, our photosynthetic process will be damaged. The long-term consequences of that are quite significant, Joe. So I think we need to pay more attention, both environmentally and geopolitically in the trade realm, to the oceans.
I want to ask you specifically about China. Before I do that, however, let me ask you about the UN's Law of the Sea Treaty. Mm-hmm. Should the president sign it, and why is it so important, in your opinion?
We should definitely ratify the treaty, which is the next step. It has to go to the U.S. Senate to do that. The importance of the treaty is that it codifies territorial ownership of coastal regions. So today we enjoy the benefit of the fact that other nations who have signed up to the treaty can't simply expand their territorial sea. If China weren't part of that treaty, they could claim the South China Sea under the United Nations Treaty. That would be hugely detrimental to us. For some reason, the United States has stayed outside of that treaty. It's a kind of a suspicion of the United Nations more than anything else. We're the only significant sea power in the world that hasn't signed that treaty. We ought to get into it because it's to our advantage to do so.
Okay, so let's talk about China specifically. As you've mentioned, they've made aggressive efforts in the past several years to gain ownership of the South China Sea. You say that they're on track to double defense spending by 2020 and have They have illegally constructed nearly 3,000 acres of artificial islands in the region. Why do that, and why is that so detrimental to not just us, but the rest of the world?
Yeah, let's give a little comparison here so our listeners can understand this. China's claims would be as though the United States woke up on a Monday morning and said, we now own the Caribbean Sea. It's
right.
a historical American body of water. We own all the hydrocarbons that are under it. We will control all the shipping routes. They are internal waters to the United States. It's a preposterous claim. This is what China is seeking to do in the South China Sea because they want those hydrocarbons. They want control of those shipping routes. 80% of Asia's trade goes through that South China Sea. So it's a way they can put pressure and constrain the economies of our allies, Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, Australia, New Zealand, and so forth. So China is playing a long game here to try and gain sovereignty over that space. We cannot allow that to happen. If we do, China truly will dominate Asia to our detriment over the long throw of this century.
One of the things that you talk about, and I think it's really interesting, you mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership and our withdrawal from that. And that really has an effect on the alliances between the U.S. and those nations surrounding the South China Sea. So who would help us out in this? Japan, Australia, and Vietnam. We are no longer close with them in relationship to this particular matter.
Correct. And this is the geopolitical failure that has been caused by withdrawing from that treaty. I would argue, additionally, economically, the treaty makes overall sense for the United States. It was rejected, the Trans-Pacific Partnership was rejected on the basis of concerns of how it would impact some of our domestic economic industries. And I can understand that, and I'm somewhat sympathetic to it, although I think those problems can be addressed, and we could reap the overall economic benefit of the partnership, as well as the clear, indisputable geopolitical benefit. So walking away from Asia is roughly like the British walking away from Europe. It's a mistake, and if we do it, we'll come to...
Sorry about that, Admiral. How are you?
Everything's fine. I think I had just finished up talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and why it's important.
You absolutely did. So let me ask another question about another threat, and this is something you write about, which is Russia. Russia's military, you believe, also presents a significant threat.
I do, and particularly in a maritime vein. Russia doesn't have the global economy that we do. They're never going to be able to compete with us toe-to-toe overall in the military. So they're creating a specialization, and an area they've chosen is in the maritime sphere. They're going to build 100 ships over the next 3 years, many more than we will. They're going to operate extremely high-performance submarines all over the world. Their hypersonic cruise missiles pose a real threat to our aircraft carriers. Russia will rise at sea and challenge us, and we need to meet that challenge, not only militarily, but again, with trade, with our transatlantic partnerships, with our NATO partners. We need to work together with our allies to face that.
When it comes to the situation of overall terrorism and, of course, ISIS and just the geopolitics of the day, and I'm going to ask a very complicated question and perhaps the easiest way I know how, which is, do we know what we're doing right now?
do we ever know what we're doing? I guess I would say that a common failure of the current administration and the last two administrations is that we really haven't had a coherent strategic plan globally. And I'll sketch one out for you. First, you know I'm going to say this, we need to focus on our maritime ability to project power, to control the seas, because it's fundamental to our economy. Secondly, we need to strengthen our ties, not reduce them, with our NATO allies. Thirdly, in Asia, we need stronger ties with Japan, South Korea, the Australians, the Kiwis in New Zealand, the Singaporeans. We need not quite a NATO, but a coherent package of partners there. Fourth, we need to fundamentally take apart the Islamic State and gain back the territory that they've taken. That's on, if you will, the offensive military side. We need a strong alliance of trade around the world, a global trade approach, because it's been shown again and again that's the best course for America. And then third and finally, we need to step up culturally. We need to hold our values. We need to treasure democracy, liberty, freedom of speech, freedom of expression. We need strategic communication to do that more effectively. So none of these three administrations have really sketched out a strategic approach for the nation, and I fault all three of them, frankly, for that.
I want to talk to you in our just 2 minutes left, and that is about what happened over the weekend with the USS Fitzgerald.
Sure.
You, of course, are retired, but give us a sense, as best you can understand, or perhaps help us understand, of how something like that happens. 7 sailors killed in the incident where the USS Fitzgerald collides with a container ship. How does something like that happen?
Think of it as you're on an 8-lane freeway and traffic is flowing at high speed. It's at night. All you see are headlights. The road is curvy ahead of you, and yet there are no guard barriers, there's no traffic separation scheme. Anybody can drive their car anywhere they want, to the left, to the right. They can turn around, they can stop. That's what it's like in the ocean at night in a well-traveled shipping lane. There's 400 or 500 ships in that zone at any given time. My guess is what we're going to find is the tanker was ahead of the destroyer. It suddenly turned around. There was a collision. The Navy ship did not respond in time. There'll probably be fault on both of those bridges. What's really surprising, frankly, is that this does not happen more often than it does. We ought to close by saying this is a tragic incident, but those sailors behaved heroically and saved their ship. It could easily have sunk. The captain was incapacitated. The strike was right at his cabin on the ship. He had to be airlifted off. So those sailors, without their captain, saved that ship. That's, if you will, the silver lining in this very tragic incident.
And there is no reason to believe that it was not an accident.
Not at this point. We have, because these are surface ships, we'll be able to reconstruct their track with extreme accuracy. Investigators are swarming over both those ships now, replaying all the tapes, just like you do in an airline accident. We'll be able to do a minute-by-minute reconstruction of what happened. I suspect we'll find that there were mistakes made on both of the bridge. It's a tragic accident.
The book is fascinating. I learned so much from it. It is entitled Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans. Admiral James Stavridis, I thank you very much for joining us this morning, and I thank you for your great service. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Joe. What a pleasure being with you and your listeners.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics in the World's Oceans. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.